everybody. Welcome back to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson, and I have an amazing, amazing show for you today with Ashok Gupta. He's one of the leaders in brain retraining and neuroplasticity, so I'm so excited to be having him on the show today. If this is your first time listening, let me tell you a little bit about the show. This is an online radio podcast, and we help people turn challenges into opportunities. You can sign up for free for the newsletter and also to get downloads of each show in iTunes. Just go to the show page at zentertainment.org. Ashok Gupta is one of the leaders in the field of neuroplasticity and brain retraining, and you might say this is the field of psychoneuroimmunology, which studies communication between the brain and the immune system. You can find out more about his program at guptaprogramme.com. He has a professional clinic in London, which was first established in 2001, and he specializes in treating disorders such as ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, MCS, anxiety disorders, and other related conditions. His treatment involves a series of brain retraining exercises that are designed to retrain the amygdala and other parts of the brain that are stuck in a state of hyperarousal. Thank you, Ashok, so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell us more about your background, how you got CFS, and what happened?
Okay, so basically I got CFS at university. It was a very difficult time for me at that particular point, because obviously you have your whole life ahead of you and you don't know what's happening to you. And so I had it to a moderate level for about 3 years. So I was never completely bedbound, although I was housebound on certain periods. And like everybody, I started researching, trying to understand what was going on. The doctors would just say I had depression, but I knew that that wasn't what I had. And so I did lots of research into the brain neurology of emotion and looked at something that we're going to talk about today, which is defensive responses or protective responses. And I started understanding the mechanism that was probably going on in my brain that was causing all these symptoms. And gradually, you know, in a very ad hoc process, I was able to get myself better. I then did more research into the brain neurology and published a couple of medical papers on this particular hypothesis, on the neurological hypothesis. And from then on, I set up a clinic to help others with the condition. So in a nutshell, that's the kind of journey that I went on.
Did you ever do lightning process? And I was also wondering what led you into the neuro-linguistic programming aspect?
No, I never did the lightning process, although I was aware of it. I had trained as a NLP practitioner and a hypnotherapist even before the lightning process came along. And my treatments were more based on something called timeline therapy, which was all about saying you have a line in front of you which represents the future, and you have a line behind you that represents the past. And it was something where I really realized that we can tap into some of these aspects of the timeline and imagine people, getting people to imagine a future where they continue with a particular brain pattern, or we can imagine a different future. And that's really where the treatment started coming from, was timeline therapy.
How long did it take you to fully recover once you developed the steps that you needed to get there?
I think for me, it was very ad hoc, and I hadn't actually developed a formal process. So it probably took, maybe 6 to 9 months or something like that. But that was because I didn't have a process to follow. It was very much experimenting on myself. So in some ways, I was the first one to kind of experiment on myself with these particular techniques. But nowadays, you know, obviously that doesn't need to represent how long it should take someone to recover necessarily.
Research on the amygdala traditionally focused on emotional threats. New research shows that the amygdala is actually involved in protective mechanisms related to chemicals and immunological threats as well. Can you explain the amygdala hypothesis and also explain how other parts of the brain are involved?
Yes, I'd love to. Well, this is the really exciting thing about this research, that, as you say, there's so much research that's been done on the amygdala and associated brain structures, but they've generally been applied to what we might traditionally call psychological conditions. And I love starting with the biggest question of all, you know, why are we here? and I mean it from a, you know, not from the big philosophical question of why are we here, but from a purely scientific perspective. We're here because over millions of years of evolution, our ancestors have been able to develop systems in the body, physiological systems, immune systems, from various mammalian bodies through to human beings now, that have protected us against our environment and the situations that we encounter in life. And the body and the brain doesn't distinguish between what is a physiological threat or a physical threat and what is an emotional threat. As far as the brain is concerned, its responsibility, or certainly the limbic part of the brain, its responsibility is to protect us from danger and ensure our survival so that our genes can be passed on to the next generation and so on. And the amygdala's job is to protect us from those dangers. So that one of its core roles is in the perception of threat, perception of danger. And emotionally, we would say the dangers that we used to face as cavemen or whatever might be, you know, wild animals, fights with rival tribes, etc. So our amygdala would fire off because we were in physical danger. And that's what we traditionally think of the role of the amygdala. But actually, the amygdala, the insula, and many other brain structures that we'll talk about are also involved in immunological threats. Okay, so when we are responding to a particular bacteria or a particular virus, we know that aspects of the limbic system are triggered. And to me, this makes perfect sense because the brain is where we house the software that determines what is dangerous and what isn't dangerous. So our body is like the hardware, and our nervous system is like the software. So within the limbic system, our brain stores the information to decide what is of danger physically, emotionally, mentally, what is of danger to us and what is not of danger. And the brain does not differentiate between a physiological threat, an emotional threat, an immunological threat. All it wants to do is ensure our survival. And this becomes then very exciting because then we realize that actually this is why most physical illnesses involve an emotional component and most emotional illnesses house a physiological component.
That's interesting.
And we know that from psychoneuroimmunology. And therefore, when we're looking at any condition, whether it be something, anything from cancer or heart disease or CFS or depression or anxiety, we have to develop a holistic approach because both the physiology and the emotional part of the mind are involved in every defensive reaction because these conditions come from defending ourselves. You know, when we think of flu or colds, we might think that this virus has suddenly got into our body and is attacking us, and that's why we've got all these symptoms. But in fact, the vast majority of symptoms that are triggered in our bodies are from our own immune system defending against that particular virus. And that's something very important to bear in mind when we think about these conditions.
Can you tell people more about the HPA axis? What is it? How is it affected by the amygdala retraining process? And what is its role in ME?
Okay, so I think just to take a step back, let me just describe the hypothesis and then I'll come on to the HPA axis because mm-hmm. I can only describe that if I describe the hypothesis first. So the hypothesis is that somebody goes through a very difficult time in their lives where they encounter emotional stress or some kind of mental stress combined with a physical illness. So in the case of CFS, this tends to be some kind of flu virus or cold, or it tends to be some stomach bug. In the case of fibromyalgia, it tends to be some kind of localized pain condition that then generalizes to the entire body. And in the case of MCS, it tends to be stress combined with exposure to a particular environmental toxin, mold, etc. And normally our brains enact a physiological or immune response to defend us against the danger, and then that switches itself off. But when we're under stress, we know that our immune system is not so effective and our physiological defense mechanisms are not so effective. So it takes longer to fight off that virus, let's say. And during that particular period of time, the brain becomes traumatized to exposure to that virus or chemical or whatever. And the reason it becomes traumatized is because it thinks that our very survival is under threat. And as we know, every year, many people die of flu, and many, especially elderly people or people with compromised immune systems, actually die from flu. So it's not illogical for the brain to conclude that if our immune system isn't up to scratch, we are in physical danger. So then the immune system, the amygdala, the insula, the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, they all work together to condition the brain to become hyper-defensive. And so the brain goes into a traumatized conditioned state where it keeps triggering aspects of the immune system even when the original threat has gone. So once someone actually gets better from the flu, so let's say they fought off the flu virus or they've fought off mono or et cetera, any kind of virus, it's left a legacy in the brain, which is that any time the brain detects even a slight bit of evidence or a clue that the virus is still here, it inappropriately keeps triggering aspects of the immune system or aspects of the pain response mechanisms or aspects of defensive mechanisms against chemicals. And so those very symptoms themselves persuade the brain that we are in danger. And so then the brain responds to the symptoms in the body. But when the brain responds, it then triggers those very symptoms, which then it detects and magnifies and thinks that we're in danger. And then we get caught in a vicious cycle. And once we're in that vicious cycle, the level of symptomology that we have will be dependent on how vicious that particular cycle is. So with CFS, for instance, we can have people who are virtually bedbound because their nervous systems and their immune systems are in hyper defense response to a non-existent threat. Just to qualify that, sometimes people have very high viral titers. So they have a large amount of opportunistic viruses in their bodies because their immune system is just not effective at getting to the right viruses and bacteria. So there can be evidence of infection, but the point is it's the immune system is not effective anymore in being able to deal with it because it's overreacting all the time. And so we can go from people from bedbound right through to people who are able to function in daily life but still have the condition. And traditionally, people have come and said, well, you're only treating CFS because actually, if you had proper ME, that would mean that there's no way that there'd be any way your treatment could help them. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, actually, these conditions are all on a spectrum depending on the how deep the level of conditioning is in the brain and how much the software has got traumatized against these particular symptoms. And then it can create symptoms of what we traditionally call ME, which is far more, neuroimmune, where the person is close to being bedbound or bedbound as such. And so all of these symptoms are being caused by our own bodies reacting to something that's non-existent. And our bodies always err on the side of caution. It thinks, okay, I've learned to over-respond and maybe this person doesn't like the feeling of having all these symptoms, but I'd rather do that and keep this person alive than, you know, give them a normal homeostatic balance that would make them feel good in general day to day. And where the HPA axis comes in is the HPA axis, so the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, is one of our stress responses. It's part of the stress response. And that is part of the sympathetic nervous system. And when we over-trigger that particular axis, after a while, it can no longer respond because it becomes exhausted. So some people get diagnosed with adrenal exhaustion. Or we know that many patients tend to have lower levels of cortisol in response to a particular threat. So the HPA axis no longer is able to respond to the stresses of life, which is why often patients with CFS feel that even a small activity is a huge chore, a huge undertaking psychologically. And just even being able to generate the effort to be able to do it feels just impossible because the HPA axis, which is one of the main axes that we are able to engage in activity, is no longer responding. And the worst thing that someone can do is try and go and exercise and force themselves to exercise because the body and the muscles are not getting the resources that they need in order to be able to exercise.
How do people do your program and pace while also not focusing on body symptoms?
Right. Well, this is a very good question. This is a part of mindfulness that people maybe have a few issues with. What we're doing is we are breaking, using the program, we are learning to retrain our amygdala and our insula to no longer focus on the dangers of the body or the dangers of the symptoms in the body. And so we are retraining that, but at the very same time, we have to pace ourselves. And that pacing is about operating at our boundary, but not pushing the boundary out too hard. Yeah. Now, normally when someone paces, they maybe check in with their bodies maybe once or twice an hour to see how the body is doing and what's an appropriate level of activity. But what we notice is that unconsciously, people with CFS are checking their bodies hundreds of times in an hour, or there's almost a permanent awareness of how the body is feeling. And therefore, the amygdala is constantly stimulated because it thinks it's in a state of danger continually. So pacing is about doing the retraining, so doing the seven-step retraining, and at the end of the seven steps, making a calm, rational pacing decision that does not involve a defensive response. So the both of them are very, very important together.
Is there scientific proof that this process is going on? And do you think that this process in the brain could be going on more for some people than for others?
This is a deductive hypothesis in the sense that it's very difficult to directly prove what we're talking about here. So there's a combination of different things. There is proof when it comes to conditioning in the immune system that the insula and the amygdala and the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, are involved in conditioning in the immune system. And that's been proven in animal models. Yeah. So just to give you a brief example of that, they've taken groups of rats and they fed them sweet water with an immunosuppressant. And they find that the rat's immune system is suppressed. Later, they repeat this process until eventually they can give the rats just sweet water and the rat's immune system responds accordingly and is suppressed. And when they find out where the conditioning lies, so where is the software pattern, and this research has been done over the last 5 years or so, they found that the software, as in the programming, is stored in the insula and partly in the amygdala as well. And what I believe is that the conditioning of the immune system lies in the insula and the conditioning of the nervous system lies in the amygdala. And therefore, some patients will have purely a nervous system response, which therefore on the spectrum, they lie more in the field of an area of anxiety, right through on the other spectrum where actually most of the conditioning is in the insula, where they will have not only nervous system response, but they will also have a lot of immune symptoms as well, which is why this condition is a syndrome, a complex collection of symptoms individual to each patient, because it all depends on the original conditioning event at the beginning of the condition and what was going on in the immune system and the nervous system at the beginning. Once it's learnt its responses, then it will create a particular pattern of symptoms for that person.
Some people come into the retraining process thinking that they have to do every single thing of, you know, every aspect of the program perfectly. But you say that any stress that you put on yourself to do this properly only makes it worse. I appreciate that you say to do it with a happy-go-lucky attitude, do what you can, be satisfied with that, commit to as much as you can. And I find that really helpful for people, especially who tend to have boot camp, perfectionist types of personalities.
Yes, and I'm very used to dealing with those kinds of personalities because, you know, let's be clear, I am very certain that this is a real physiological condition with abnormalities in the brain. So I'm sure everyone who understands what I'm talking about knows that that's what I believe. And we are using these processes to retrain the brain. It's very different to psychological processes like CBT. At the same time, what we do notice is the kinds of people who get these conditions do tend to fit into certain categories where they are more prone to pushing beyond their limits and find it very difficult to relax their nervous system. And they tend to be people who are achiever orientated. And that doesn't mean someone who's a high flying banker or lawyer or whatever. It can be anyone. People who are helpers in the sense that they are always interested in supporting and helping other people at the expense of their own health. And people who are people pleasers or approval seekers, where they're constantly on edge worrying what people are thinking of them. And that's not exclusively so, but I definitely notice more of a trend of those types of personalities who get these types of conditions. And the reason is that at the beginning of the condition, they are far more likely to not listen to their bodies and far more likely to listen, to push beyond their limits at the beginning of the condition, which then causes the conditioning event in the brain.
The prefrontal cortex allows us to choose what we will pay attention to. So can we change our automatic patterning and programming by paying attention to different things in new ways?
Exactly. That's exactly how it works. That the brain can only focus on one or two dangers at a time, right? Or what is what they call emotionally significant or evolutionarily significant. And so many patients will often observe that temporarily, if their mind is completely distracted and engaged in another danger, which is not to do with their bodies or another thing they're having to deal with, they temporarily feel their bodies feeling a bit better and loosening because the tightness of that defense response is stopped. And what's happening there is there's several things. First of all, in the insula part of the brain is the part of the brain that takes in all the incoming data from the body and then interprets it and passes it onto the amygdala if it thinks it's of significance. And what one of the things we're doing here is by using the retraining, we are training the insula to not hyperactivate and hyper magnify the incoming signals from the body. And we know from other studies that the insula is definitely involved in those kinds of retraining processes. We have had people who've had it for decades, 30, 40 years, who've been able to make the improvement that they want and have gone on to make full recoveries. And some of those stories are actually on our website, some of the written stories on there. And, you know, we get so many stories and we don't even document all of them, and we probably should document them better.
Yes, yes, yes.
And actually, the good news is that what matters is not how long you've had the condition, but how you've created an optimal environment in your own emotional makeup to be able to retrain your brain at that particular point right now. Yeah, because once the conditioning is in, the conditioning is in the brain. It's doing its responses and it's learned to do that. Yeah. Now, whether you choose to retrain a year after that conditioning event happened or 10 or 20 years doesn't make too much difference. What matters is the commitment to retraining and the belief that you have that you can retrain these particular hyperactive responses.
Let's go back to something you said a few minutes ago when you mentioned that a chemical exposure or a virus can leave a legacy in the brain. Sometimes that threat is no longer there and it's non-existent, but the body's still stuck in this overactive immune response as if it is there. It's still fighting the war. Now, is the retraining process different for people who actually do have current infections or triggers that are presently causing symptoms?
Okay, the process is pretty similar, and I'll explain why. What happens is our immune system is at a delicate state of balance. And when it's at an energized level, when it's at its optimum level, the immune system is designed to be triggered, fight off an infection, and come back to normal. But when the immune system goes out of homeostatic balance, it then starts responding to dangers that are no longer there. And then infections that it should be fighting off, opportunistic infections, such as HHV and those kinds of things, those things are able to flourish because the immune system is no longer catching them. Yeah. And therefore, those opportunistic viruses can contribute to symptoms. There's no denial, right? So opportunistic viruses and bacterial infections can contribute to symptoms in the body. And so, but you might say, well, what can we do about that? There's not much we can do about those opportunistic infections. Instead, what we can focus on is doing the retraining, bringing our nervous system and our immune system back to normal homeostatic balance or healthy homeostatic balance. And then our bodies can naturally take care of these opportunistic infections themselves. And a classic example of this, I believe, is Lyme disease. Now, Lyme disease affects many people, far more people than are ever diagnosed. And I believe that what happens is, in Lyme disease, those people who, there are many people who fight off the infections because their immune systems are strong enough to be able to do that. But in a small number of cases, the immune system, for whatever reason, isn't strong enough to fight it off. And so it becomes an ongoing opportunistic viral bacterial infection in the body. And therefore, that's why we've had people who've come to us who've had Lyme disease who've also been able to get better using this retraining.
Okay, so one of the things that I thought that was great about your program, you encourage people to see it as a menu. So not everything on the menu is right for everyone. And I wondered if you could share what are the key things that you encourage everyone to do in the program, and what are some of the things that you consider to be more optional?
Okay, so this is for those people who are already doing the program, this was outlined in one of the summary tools document that was sent out via email. So that's one of the best documents that people can read as a good summary of what is optional and what is non-optional. But in general, what we find is there are two core components of retraining that are most important. The first one is the 7-step retraining process. Yeah. And as you know, sometimes some patients can't do 7 steps because it's too much effort. So we have shorter versions like the 3-step and the short version and whatever. So there's the actual amygdala retraining of the retraining steps when you detect a defense response in your body. That's non-optional. That's the core of it. And to support that process is daily meditation or daily deep relaxation, whatever works for people. And just to give you a bit of background, we know that probably when we're retraining, we have safety neurons coming from our prefrontal cortex, going down to the amygdala and down to the insula. And certainly we know that those safety neurons, when we look at animal studies, that's what we find. We find extra neurons connecting the prefrontal cortex, the orbital cortex, down to the amygdala and down to the insula, which in my mind is telling those parts of the brain that we no longer need to defend ourselves. And what we find is that in meditation can increase the gray matter, the prefrontal gray matter in the front part of the brain. And we know in CFS that there is a deficiency of gray matter in the prefrontal cortex. So daily meditation is a way that we can strengthen our prefrontal cortex and its ability to control the out-of-control responses from our limbic system. And we advise at least one meditation in the morning, following some breathing, and then extra meditations in the evening. And we provide lots of guided meditations that people can use.
I'm going to ask a question that actually incorporates a few questions that were sent to me. And this is for those of you who are doing this program. This is about rounds, Ashok. So when someone's doing rounds, first, do they need to time them? Or can they just do a couple rounds in a very relaxed way without timing them? And here's, let me ask you that first.
There's no need to time it, no. Okay, the purpose of the 7 steps is really that you feel each step. And at the end of the 7 steps, you feel different in the sense that you are no longer being pulled in a negative, despairing way along the left-hand path.
I love that. And I'll tell you what has worked for me, and maybe it would work for some of you. We had some questions on where people said that when they're dealing with a lot of, the harder ME symptoms, it's really tough to visualize and to stand there and to get yourself in a different place when your body feels one way. And this is a suggestion that's worked for me that I want to share, but Ashok, I'd like your feedback on this as well. So what I do is when I do a round, my goal is just to get to a better place. And even if it only means going from a 2 to a 4, I see that as a success. I don't force myself to go from a 2 to a 10, although I have had times in rounds where I feel this amazing sense of wellness and I'm able to tap into that. But as long as I leave the round, even a little bit better than when I started, I consider that a success. And I don't put pressure on myself to get in this state of warm fuzzies that's very extreme. What's your feedback on that?
Yes, it is about a step-by-step process. It's not about jumping ahead many, many steps. Whatever retraining you do, it is having a beneficial effect. The fact that you have interrupted one of the signals coming from the brain alerting us of the danger is a success in and of itself. And when you imagine healthiness at the end of the right path, what matters is that it is a better feeling than you started with. Yeah. Yep. And remember the very important phrase that I use with everybody. We are not doing the retraining to make our body feel better and to get rid of the symptoms. We are doing the retraining in order to feel better emotionally at the end of the right path. Because when we feel better emotionally at the end of the right path, that signals to the amygdala and the insula that we aren't in danger. And then the second step, which we're not in control of, is when the insula and the amygdala switch off immune and neurological responses. We can't directly control that, but what we can control is our emotional environment, which acts as a trigger that we are not in danger anymore.
And I want to share one little illustration of my process of this is that, you know, if you stop every 2 seconds and say, is it better? Is it better? Did it do anything? It just creates more focus on what's wrong. And an example of that is that when I go to visit my family, my dad has a garden, and sometimes I help him in the garden, and we plant seeds. Now, strawberries especially, they take forever to grow. You know, it can be a year, it can be longer. And we don't plant them and then sit there and say, are you growing yet? Are you growing yet? We just trust that we planted the seeds and that, you know, generally speaking, unless some animal gets into them, but we pretty much assume that, you know, we're going to get what we planted. So look at the steps, look at your healing processes, whatever you're doing as planting seeds, and don't keep checking in to see if they're growing. Just trust.
Yeah, that's a beautiful analogy. It's a beautiful analogy. It's exactly the same way. If we plant seeds and then nothing's growing and we move the earth and push the seeds around going, come on, come on, why aren't you growing? Then actually we prevent them from growing. And in the same way, patience is very important. That's in fact where the word patient actually came from originally, is someone that has to be patient. And so with the healing process and the recovery process, it's actually a very Zen-like process in the sense that you'll get better when you hardly notice that you've got better. Now, let me explain what I mean. If your focus is sitting at home waiting to get better from this condition and your whole focus is on your condition, then naturally your amygdala and your insula are constantly assessing how you're feeling physically. But as we say in the program, getting better from this condition is a combination of amygdala retraining and distraction. That what we're doing is saying, rather than the focus of my life being on getting better from the condition, I now find other things that take up my attention. And the getting better from this condition is a sideshow. So it's retraining, distraction. And when my mind is so engaged in the distractions, then the amygdala in insula think, hey, this person can't be in so much danger because they aren't paying so much attention to getting better and getting rid of this condition. Therefore, we're no longer in danger. And people find that they are so engaged in other things as much as possible, that as they get better, there's less of a concern about whether they're going to get better or how they're going to get better or how quickly it's happening, because they're not putting that pressure and expectation on themselves anymore. And it happens as a surprise almost over a period of time, because they're not focused on, has it worked? Has it worked? Has it worked?
It's challenging for somebody listening who might be bedbound or barely able to walk or talk. They might think, how in the world can I focus in on other things when I'm in this state? And I wondered if you could just speak to somebody listening who's in that condition.
I totally empathize with that. And in those situations, what we say to people is, it's a gentle step-by-step chipping away of the fear. And we've had many people who've got better who have been bedbound. And the way that they've told us that they've done it is that they've allowed themselves to spend longer in meditation because they've had to. But they've also listened to audiobooks and the radio, where what they've been able to do is find something that's always been of interest to them and being able to just gently listen to things without being too involved in them. So they might be very gentle fiction books or whatever. And then through that process of having an enjoyable experience of audiobooks, they've gradually been able to retrain. And for other people, it's actually writing. So people have found that actually, you know, I always say, the joke I always make is people should write their autobiography, right? Everyone's got a lot of wisdom to share, and it may never get published, but just to write your memoirs, write the background to your life. Why should only famous people write memoirs? I think everyone should write their memoirs as a reflection of what they've experienced in their lives. Keeping certain characters anonymous, of course, in case the books ever get out. But this is often a time for us to, when we're getting better from these conditions, it's an opportunity for us to also focus on our emotional growth and reflect on our lives. And I appreciate that people have limited levels of energy. So it's doing what we can without pushing our boundaries out too far. But I'm sure there are all of us can find certain creative pursuits, creative writing, gardening, pottery, a hobby, something that we'd like to gently spend time with that is an engaging distraction, but not energy sucking at the same time.
An experiment was done by the Institute of Heart Math, and the paper written about it was titled Local and Non-Local Effects of Coherent Heart Frequencies on Conformational Changes of DNA. That's a big, big thing there. But what it's really saying is it's talking about how conscious attention affects DNA. Do you know about this experiment?
I'm aware of, I have heard about that experiment. I don't know the ins and outs of it.
Well, they took human placenta DNA, which is a very pristine form of DNA, of course, and they placed it in a container. All right, so they had 28 vials of this DNA, and they were given one each to 28 trained researchers. Each researcher had been trained how to generate and feel feelings. Now, this was not an intellectual process. Feel feelings, and they each had strong emotions. So what they discovered was that DNA actually changed its shape. It literally changed its shape according to the feelings of the researchers. And when the researchers felt gratitude, love, appreciation, the DNA responded by relaxing. I mean, how amazing is that? And the strands actually unwound, and the length of the DNA became longer. And then when the researchers, as they were trained to do, felt anger, fear, frustration, stress, the DNA responded by tightening up. It got really tight, it became shorter, and then it switched off many DNA codes. So isn't this an amazing experiment to show the power of emotional states on our bodies?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that sounds like an amazing study, and I'd love for you to be able to send me any papers that you have on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was recently presenting at a conference in New York on CFS, and there were researchers there looking at gene expression. And it was very interesting. They were noticing certain patterns of gene expression in ME and chronic fatigue syndrome. But what was also very interesting is that meditation itself changes gene expression.
Yes.
Every time we go to in a certain mood or a certain mental environment, it changes gene expression. We used to think that our genes were very fixed and we had certain responses to the environment and that was it. But now we know that we have influence over our gene expression and how we operate in the world through our mental, physical, and emotional behaviors and states of mind. And that's incredibly powerful, because then the whole field of psychoneuroimmunology, where we know that our psychological state of mind affects our body, now has a very distinct process via which that can occur. And that's occurring through the physiology, through the hormonal changes. But now we know at the very core DNA, the very expression of our genes, the very core of software of how our body operates in the world is now being affected by our state of mind. And so no doctor can say now, oh, well, the body is like a car and we operate on the car and it's a fixed system. It's not a fixed system. Our bodies are constantly changing depending on our responses to the environment. And that's incredibly empowering.
Meditation is a part of your program. There are so many ways to do meditation, and everybody can find the way that works best for them. For me, I just sit, I pray, and I listen. That's what I do. And then I also watch my thoughts, whatever concerns I have or anything, like as if it's they're floating by and I'm the observer of them. So in that way, it's like I can, I don't know, sort of process them without being in them. And I set a timer for 20 minutes. And it is challenging. I mean, sometimes the first 5 or 10 minutes, you feel like, no way can I just sit here and do this. And the process of doing it is really the process of healing. So you just have to show up. Well, I had another couple questions here. A lot of people are also doing medical treatments, or, you know, some supplements or some treatments here and there while they're retraining. And does it have to be one or the other?
No. So what we say to people is, if they are on any kind of medication and there would be withdrawal effects if they came off that medication, then we encourage people to stay on that medication whilst they do the program. And we have a lot of people who are on antidepressant, anti-anxiety drugs, and we say, keep the dose the same, retrain, and as you feel stronger, then in consultation with your physician, you can very slowly come off those drugs. Now, when it comes to supplements and things like that, we generally say, do you genuinely feel that those supplements and whatever you're taking are helping you? And if you genuinely can say you're absolutely sure they're helping you, then stay on them. Because we know of a lot of people spending thousands of dollars actually on treatments that are nothing better than placebo. Because actually, when they do our program, for instance, they come off those supplements and actually there's no change, you know, whatsoever. So it's really about continue with things that you're doing as long as you can, you know, you're pretty sure, you're genuinely sure that it's a positive impact on your health rather than it's something that's holding you back.
We are seeing new research here in the U.S. coming out of Case Western Reserve University, where they're getting closer to understanding the role of fungal infections and candida in causing MS. Since this is also a major contributor to ME and CFS for some people, why do you think ME is being treated as a limbic system impairment while MS is not?
Well, I don't know that particular research in terms of MS, so I don't know how direct the link or how direct the cause actually is. Certainly what we know is that when our bodies and our systems are under stress, the balance of bacteria, fungal infections in the gut changes and it goes into imbalance. Yeah. Now that imbalance can then further contribute to symptoms. Yeah, that is for sure. And that's why there are certain nutritionists or whatever who believe that actually ME is purely caused by candida, fungal infections, gut disorders, etc., etc. But once again, I would say that those symptoms are yet again further symptoms of an immune system and a nervous system that is not in balance. Now, what happens is sometimes people do go on restrictive diets or take certain supplements that means that they temporarily feel better. And they feel that, aha, I've cracked it. I found the reason for why my condition is here. And they go into a very positive spiral loop where they actually are unconsciously have retrained the amygdala and the insula that they're no longer in danger. And therefore, defensive responses are no longer needed. And therefore, they think that they've cured themselves from the restrictive diet and supplements. But then another shock happens in their lives. And they often find that then the symptoms come back, even though they are still on the restrictive diet and the supplements. And as I said, it's because I still see those particular things as symptoms rather than core reasons behind the condition.
We're focusing not on what is happening, but why it is happening.
Yes, exactly. If you look, I present often at CFS conferences, and if you walk into a room, there are every single aspect of medicine is represented in that room, right? So you have endocrinologists, you have neurologists, you have muscle experts, et cetera, et cetera, so rheumatologists. And all of them are noticing abnormalities in the body and say, aha, we found this abnormality, therefore we think that this could be one of the reasons behind the condition. And you sit there for 3 days in these conferences with wildly different views as to what's causing the condition. And for me, the very simple explanation is that, yes, everyone is correct. All of these different parts of the body are malfunctioning because at the core of it, it's our nervous system that is no longer in balance. It's our immune system that's no longer in balance. And therefore, every cell and every organ in our body, every muscle in our body is affected by this condition. And it can't be localized. It can't be a localized problem. It must be a centralized problem in the nervous system. And that's why, for me, the brain is the core reason why this is happening, the core underlying reason.
Now, if new symptoms come up during the retraining process, how does someone know when to say thanks but no thanks? Or, you know, another way would be to say, if someone thinks of symptoms as dangerous, it can trigger the limbic system, right? But at the same time, if new things come up and they're not resolving through the retraining, should someone see a doctor?
What we say is that if a new symptom comes up, of course, you know, get it checked by your doctor just to see that it's nothing that's of a kind of organic physical cause. And if not, then generally it's because of the underlying processes that we've been talking about today. And remember, because the nervous system affects every part of the body, every system is affected. And as you retrain, the balance of symptoms changes. I mean, people notice this in their lives anyway, that when you have these conditions, your collection of symptoms today may be very different from what they were 3 months ago or a year ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. And especially whilst you're retraining. And the reason for that is as you're retraining, you are literally changing the nervous system and the immune system responses, which creates a different collection of symptoms. And a classic example of this is we often find that as people retrain and they get their health back and they physically start feeling a lot better, sometimes they start experiencing temporarily some more feelings of anxiety. So they physically feel great, but they have more symptoms of anxiety, or they may have a depressive episode or whatever. Or they may find that a new symptom like IBS comes up out of the blue. And what I say to them is, don't worry about it. You know, obviously get it checked out if you need to get it checked out, but keep going with the retraining, because ultimately it's a rocky road to get back to your healthy state where symptoms will come and go. But if you spend too long worrying about why this symptom is here and why this one has gone away, then you're too involved in self-analysis, and that's just causing more vicious cycles. So it's just let it go and keep going with the retraining.
When someone has multiple personality disorder, in one of their personalities, they might need glasses. And then in their other personality, they have perfect vision, yet they're in the same body.
Yes. And I must admit, I haven't necessarily come across that particular thing. And I can imagine it being, you know, probably a kind of more complex process when it comes to retraining. And definitely they would need therapeutic support with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not even approaching that for this program, but I think it's interesting how just being in that different personality can change the biochemistry of the body. It's a kind of amazing. Well, Dr. Carolyn Leaf, she's a neuroscientist, and she said, perfect love casts out fear. Love is the truth. Love, joy, peace, patience, faithfulness, and self-control. Fear is the opposite. Fear is the counterfeit, the hijacked, the incorrect. This is not normal. She says that every structure in the body and brain, every neural transmitter, every circuit, everything about your physical nature is only designed and wired to handle the positive. She said we've got no designs, no circuits to handle the negative. She wrote, in the past, they thought we had these fear circuits. They thought we evolved to have fear circuits to protect us and all this kind of nonsense. It has not been proven. A Nobel Prize winning scientist who doesn't even believe in God said, we are, as humans, wired for love. We learn to fear. Again, we as humans are wired for love. We learn to fear. And that is very significant. What do you think of that?
There's a difference between fear and caution, right? Now, fear, to me, is an extreme reaction to a situation where we are in physical danger. Yeah. So I think what this research was getting at is that 99% of what we have a fear reaction to is not actually justified. Yeah. In the cases where we're actually in physical danger, that physical fear response is designed to, you know, give more resources to our muscle so we can run away or we can fight, and it gives us that extra strength. For example, you know, those times we hear of a mother picking up a, you know, being able to lift a car because her baby's underneath. That is where the fear circuitry has magnified to the point at which it's able to give the resources to enable us to deal with a difficult situation. But 99% of when we have a fear response is unjustified, and actually caution is the right response. Caution is a normal positive emotion which enables us to navigate the world around us, and that's a positive thing. Fear is an extreme response only required when we're in physical danger, and yet it seems to operate so much in our lives. The second thing I'll say is that when it comes to love, certainly as emotional beings, I believe that our default setting is love. I believe that we are made up of love. And yes, fears, apart from the two core fears of that children are born, which is the fear of loud noises and the fear of falling, apart from that, generally, most fears are then conditioned in us depending on the environment that we are then in. And one of the core fears that offsets our ability to love is insecurity. Yeah? That actually the lack of love that we have for ourselves means that then it becomes far more difficult to navigate life. And lack of self-love can be different to self-esteem. We may hold ourselves in high self-esteem and think that we are a kind of positive or good person in general, but we may also still have low levels of self-love. And self-love means the ability to accept and approve of ourselves no matter what we achieve or don't achieve in life, or no matter what kind of person we are. And the opposite of that is when we have a very critical mind that puts us down and subtly criticizes every little move that we're making and second guesses ourselves. And in these conditions, what we find is that the ability to love ourselves is an important part of the healing process. It doesn't mean we have to suddenly be transformed in that particular path, but certainly we need to be more open to understanding why we don't love ourselves, or why we are critical, or we put ourselves down. And when we overcome that hurdle and we're able to create a rich, fertile inner state of mind where we feel more relaxed in ourselves, more contented with ourselves, more mature in our ability to love ourselves, then we find that our fear about our bodies, our fear about life, begins to easily reduce and health returns to the body. And I would guess that actually, when we're looking at, for instance, that study you mentioned about the DNA,
yes,
what we're really talking about is love. That any positive emotion is essentially a sub-emotion of love. And every negative emotion is a sub-emotion of fear, because love and fear are essentially the primary axis of the way that our minds work. And so any positive emotion that we are able to generate is a branch of love. And when we engage in that, then we're able to offset fear and offset defensive responses in our bodies. And something which people find very poignant when I talk about this is, when we fall in love with someone, it's not that that person has made us feel good and given us love. They haven't injected us with love. When we fall in love with someone, they have given us the permission to love ourselves. And that's why in that moment temporarily, we are so surprised that someone would love us so deeply that we give ourselves permission to love ourselves. And that's what creates the feel-good chemicals within us.
I just want to end today by sharing two more things with all of you. I was really impressed by some research that Greg Braden did. And one of the things that he said, you can prevent getting any virus by staying in love, joy, gratitude, and appreciation. These positive feelings maintain an incredibly strong immune system. Find something to be happy about every day, every hour, moment to moment, even if it's only for a few minutes. This is the easiest and best protection you have. So I have those four words on my wall: love, joy, gratitude, appreciation. I also want to share something that Ashok said once. It might have been in a webinar, I'm not sure. But I love this. And, you know, I wouldn't have understood any of this several years ago. I get it in such deep ways now, in new ways. So I want to share this with you and leave you with this. You cannot intellectualize your way out of this condition. What matters is your ability to connect deeply with the parts of you that are afraid and in defense mode, and calm your nervous system. Let me say that again more slowly. You cannot intellectualize your way out of this condition. What matters is your ability to connect deeply with the parts of you that are afraid and in defense mode, and to calm your nervous system. Train the nervous system to go to deeper levels of stillness, to open up a space for the body to heal. Thank you all so much for joining us. I hope this show has inspired you and opened up some new possibilities for you. And thank you, Ashok, so much for being here.
Okay, thank you so much, Joe. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at zentertainment.org. I'm Joe Davidson, and remember, you can download this episode and sign up for the newsletter on the show page at zentertainment.org. Have a great week. I'm wishing you all so much healing, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.